This is a recording of Alan Parry, who was the officer in charge of the assault party from Nine Para, who captured the Merville Battery very early in the morning of the 6th of June 1944. The recording was taken on a battlefield tour in 1973.
Thus, as I say, I was spare file. I had no command at this point. So the CO, in his wisdom, considered how I might usefully be employed. And after giving the matter some thought, he gave me four tasks. First, I was to command the battalion RV party, an enormous body of troops, totaling five, my batman, three sergeants, and a corporal. Secondly, I was to navigate the battalion from the RV to the FUP, which was a point so you know where your buses are. Thirdly, I was to be the battalion reserve. And latterly, fourthly, I was to command a force, an ad hoc force, after the assault on the battery, and attack a naval headquarters at a place called Salinel, about a kilometer away. I thought this is as in the third class, being a battalion reserve, I'd be happily standing on the touchline outside the battery, and I would watch the performance and perhaps be the better able to launch my own attack later on Salinel. Well, as I proceed, you may think that things didn't work out quite like that. I must first tell you something about the Albemarle aircraft from which we dropped. There's a photograph of this in the little pamphlet on page 18. It was a twin-engine Brute, a mid-wing, twin-tail, and was designed initially for operations by Coastal Command in the anti-submarine role. Rumor had it that the tail had a habit of falling off, and Coastal Command no longer liked this aircraft, so it was allotted to airborne forces. There was an organization called 38 Wing, which was at this time, late 43, early 44, expanding into a group, and three squadrons of Albemarles, amongst other aircraft, were allotted to it. All parties dropping at midnight 20, and there were some 30 Albemarles, took off from Harwell, RAF Harwell, at 23:10 hours, and we flew direct to our respective DZs. To get into this aircraft, you had to crawl along on all fours, climb a little ladder, then again crawl on all fours inside the fuselage, turn about, put your back against the knees of the person behind you, who was sitting in pairs, and there await the order to drop. This aircraft, however, had, uncomfortable though it was, had one redeeming feature in that it had a very large, if uninviting, aperture. And once you approached the edge of this, which you did by shuffling on your backside, when you reached the edge, there was no possibility of avoiding yourself falling through it. Well, we took off, and we arrived bang on the dot at midnight 20. We didn't, of course, know where we were. We assumed that we were in the right place, and we asked the captain of the aircraft to drop us as near as he could to the RV, perhaps 400 or 500 yards east of it, so we would have a little difficulty in finding it. As I shuffled along the floor of the aircraft, the kit bag which I carried, which was strapped to my right leg, came loose. As I went through the hole, it left my leg altogether. But fortunately, the string to which it was attached did not break, and I landed in France still attached to it. Having landed and divested myself of my harness, I took out a map and a few air photographs and a torch, and had a quick look at them. But I was not in the least bit enlightened as to where I was. I then took out my compass and ascertained more or less where north was. And that wasn't very difficult even for me to consider where west would be. I knew I should go in a westerly direction, always assuming I was dropped in the right place. Had I been dropped west of the RV, which was a possibility, I would not have known it probably. I'd have gone on west, and I would never have got to the RV. The next thing to do was to make a certain sound. Now, some 2 months or so before this operation, we had done a rehearsal exercise, and Brigadier Hill was not impressed at the speed at which troops left the DZ and concentrated in the RV. This was an ever-present problem. Various methods had been tried, but none had proved satisfactory. Now, Brigadier James Hill was, amongst other things, a great ornithologist, and he ordained that every officer, this was after this exercise I'm referring to, should be issued with a bird noise. And every officer on landing immediately would sound his bird noise, and any soldiers within earshot would rally on the source of this noise, and the officer, assuming he knew where the RV was, would conduct his party to it. Now, I still have with me at this very moment the bird noise with which I was issued in 1944. And this is the noise it made. That, gentlemen, is a Dutch Bakelite 1944 pattern. I was very conscientious about playing this thing. My party, remember, was only 5, and I reckon they couldn't be very far away. But blow as I did, waited as I did, nobody took the slightest notice of it. I assumed that they must have heard it, and they thought rather better of it. They thought they would have a better chance of getting to the RV on their own rather than coming to me and hoping I would be able to take them to it. So I was hoping that at least one of my party would rally on me, and we would decide where the RV might be, and together we would go there. Well, nobody took any notice at all. So, somewhat unhappily, I turned westwards and started moving towards what I hoped was the RV. The RV, incidentally, was, believe it or not, a bushy-top tree in an orchard. And approaching it, I suddenly became aware of the drone of heavy aircraft. I had up to this moment given no thought to these aircraft, and it was, of course, these 100 Lancasters at midnight 30, who were to bomb the battery with their 4,000-pound bombs. Unfortunately, they missed the target, and all the bombs, or a lot of them, fell on the DZ where I was. The noise was terrific. I was scared out of my wits. I bit the dust, and there prepared to meet my end. I was quite certain that I could not possibly survive this ghastly attack. It seemed to continue for a long time, though in point of fact it was no more than the scheduled 10 minutes. I could see great columns of earth going skywards. I heard the crash of falling masonry, and this, I discovered later, was the village of Gonville behind me, and I had occasion to go through that village some 3 months later, and it had been completely wrecked. Well, when this bombing stopped, I picked myself up, realized I was still alive and had all my limbs where they should be, and I set again for the RV, still not knowing if I was in the right place. Now all was quiet, except that I heard voices in the distance. I could not make out whether they were speaking English or French, German, Polish, Russian. Could be any of those languages. Then, as they approached, I realized they were speaking Canadian English. This was quite comforting. Canadian A Company of one Canadian parachute battalion was, I knew, dropping on the same DZ at the same time, and they had, as an immediate objective, an attack on a German headquarters at a place called Verville, some 2 kilometers to the east. Well, I was made up my mind that I must challenge these gentlemen, whoever they were, and at least remonstrate with them for making so much noise on an operation. So I prepared to challenge. I was this time at a gap in a hedge where there had been a gate, and I stood there, and as they approached, I challenged them. They were somewhat surprised and stopped. And I first of all remonstrated with them for making a noise, and I then demanded of them the password. They didn't know it, so I told them. And seeing that they had no weapons, I said, "Why, have you no rifles or any other weapons?" He said, "Oh, we lost them on the DZ, and we haven't yet met up with our company, and we are a little bit lost. I did not add that, well, so was I. They then said, you have a Sten gun in addition to your pistol. I said, yes. And they said, well, please hand it over. I said, no, certainly not. We had a little discussion, and eventually I did give it to them. And then before that, they said, well, who are you anyway? So I announced my identity, which did not impress them in the least. So I bade them good night, and off they went into the gloom to engage the enemy. Now, this took a minute or two. I then crossed a track, which was alongside this hedge, and entered an orchard. Now, this was an encouraging thing, because I knew that I'd have to go for an orchard in order to find this wretched bushy top tree. As I entered the orchard, I saw a figure moving some 30 or 40 yards away from me, and I dearly hoped it was not a German soldier. I stopped and looked at it, and it was, in point of fact, quite clearly a British soldier. In fact, indeed, it was my own batman, one Private Adsett, who was the first to arrive at the RV alone and unaided. I congratulated him and told him what a good job he'd done, and he looked at me and said, well, it was, I was there much later than he was, of course, said, well, what happened to you? I said, well, I had one or two little jobs to do on the DZ, and here I am. So that didn't impress him either. Well, now, I've been dragging my wretched kit bag up to this point, and it contained an Aldous lamp with which I would flash to indicate the presence of the RV to the battalion when it landed at midnight 50. And it was very much near that hour at this time. I knelt on the ground to unpack the kit bag. Out came the Aldous lamp, a lot of dry batteries, which I also carried, and my haversack, and I put my hand into the bag again and pulled out another haversack. And my batman, who was leaning over me, said, thank you very much, sir, that one is mine. Well, now, having introduced myself, as it were, to this bushy top tree, I said to Private Adsett, now, you got that tree, I will hand you the lamp, and when I give you the word, you can start flashing. He said, oh, no, you're OC party, you should go up the tree, and I'll hand you the lamp. So up the tree I shinned, and he handed me the lamp. In a matter of minutes, aircraft were overhead. And this was the battalion, well, the brigade headquarters, our own battalion, and the Canadian battalion were all landing on the same DZ. A lot of aircraft. The 9th Battalion had some 30 Dakotas, but I rather got the impression that rather less than that number. They should have been flying northeast, southwest, but they were flying southwest, northeast, east to west, west to east, all directions. And I thought, well, it's only a matter of time before there was a ghastly collision. But no, there wasn't. I couldn't see the actual drop because they were hidden from my view by trees. It seemed quite a long time before the first troops started coming to the RV. I might say at this point that none of my party, the NCOs, one from each company, had yet arrived. The procedure, therefore, was that as the soldiers came in from the DZ, they had approached me, or rather the light, and they'd be told off to go left, right, or somewhere else to concentrate in company groups. Well, they trickled in, and in due course, the CO arrived. I had been keeping a tally on the numbers coming in and was able to give the CO some indication as to the strength at that moment of the battalion. It was very much less than it should have been. We were due to leave at 02:35 hours. But before that, five gliders were to land as close as possible to the RV at the same time as the main drop of the battalions, and obviously on the same DZ. None of these gliders arrived. Three of them, as you can see from that drop on your right, contained a lot of miscellaneous stores, spare mortars, machine guns, ammunition, rifles, brain guns, anything. Bangalore torpedoes, tape, Polish mine detectors, and the lot. Most of these were, by way of being replacement stores, to, in the event of some, as inevitably would happen, being lost on a DZ, on the main drop. Well, the gliders didn't turn up. We will deal with them later. There were two more, containing each a six-pounder anti-tank gun. Now, it was considered possible that these emplacements would have some form of steel shutter at their stern end, and it would be somewhat embarrassing if we arrived here and we couldn't get in. So the CO decided that he'd bring in a couple of six-pounders. In the event, there was no steel plates, no steel shutters, so the fact that these gliders containing the guns didn't arrive did not matter. Well, our time was ticking on, and the troops were still coming in small numbers. At this hour, 0235, when we should have left the RV, the strength of the battalion was no more than about 120. The battalion group, when it left England, was something like 620, so we were very short. The CO decided to wait another 15 to 20 minutes, and in that time, perhaps another 30 had come in. So we were now about 150, that is to say, only about 25% of the battalion strength. Complete platoons were missing. There were no mortars, only one machine gun, one wireless set, very few lengths of Bangalore torpedo, no Polish mine detectors. With regard to personnel, the two FOB parties were missing. One was to duplicate the other, and they consisted of naval ratings. And their task would be, in due course, to open communications with Arethusa, and there, if necessary, to direct her fire onto the battery, which might be necessary if the land attack failed. They were missing. The other half troop of sappers, 591 Squadron, with their prepared charges, were also missing. Therefore, we would have difficulty with the guns. OC C Company, the assault company commander, was also missing. I regard this as somewhat inconvenient because it was ominous and that I might be required to step into his shoes. And so it went on. Well, we could wait no longer, and the CO gave the orders for the approach march to begin. I took, as required, my place at the head of the battalion file and navigated the battalion along a predetermined cross-country route to this FUP. We were moving very, very slowly. The distance was about, I think, something like 2,000 yards. That's a bit more. On the way, we saw to our right, and about 100 yards, I suppose, a party of Germans going in a southern direction. Quite surprisingly, they did not see us, and we didn't indicate our presence. We learned later that the division, 716 Division, this coastal division, was engaged on a normal night operation. They were having a practice alert, and that is why we saw these soldiers at this particular time. In due course, we arrived at the FUP. On the way, a member of the battery reconnaissance party, which I haven't so far mentioned, officer, and in due course I blew my whistle, and that was a signal for the assault. The art offence was merely a fence like this, not much of an obstacle. But then the minefield, which was very deep, we knew it was 100 yards deep. Before this, I should have mentioned just now, before this, when we were at this FUP, one or two machine guns opened up on us in enfilade from the next but one hedgerows behind me, where the tall trees are. That was the first fire that we experienced. And a small party under an NCO was detached to deal with it, which it did very quickly. But that was obviously a signal, as it were, for fire to be opened from elsewhere. And then fire started from the battery position, from various posts outside between here and the wire obstacle, or the anti-tank ditch. Also, at this time, gunfire started, we suspected, from a battery which we knew existed at a place called Franceville Plage on the coast. And that fire added to the general turmoil. Well, now, it was a question of every little party for itself. We had no, I should have mentioned, we had no radios, therefore there was no question of my controlling or attempting to control the actual assault. I had my own little party of 8 or 10 or a dozen soldiers, and that was that. So each little party had to do as best it could to get over the minefield and over through the wire. Now, I could hear left and right and front and rear mines going up, and obviously casualties were being suffered. That was inevitable. It was a matter of luck whether one trod on an anti-tank mine or not. The officer in charge of number 3 gun did, and it didn't do himself any good, although it didn't kill him. So, very slowly and laboriously, we got through over the minefield and through the main wire obstacle, which is quite a thing. I suppose about 10 yards thick and fairly high. Cut and torn, we arrived on, as it were, the friendly side, this side of it. And fire was now increasing. We were firing, and we were receiving further fire from this end. At this point, or before this point, I should say, the 3 coup de main gliders should have come in to land. They were to receive a certain signal from mortar flares and so on, which we hadn't got, and therefore they couldn't land, which was just as well when you consider the very heavily crated nature of the terrain. Had they attempted to land on the battery, I suppose they would have just gone arse over apex and there'd been a lot of casualties. What actually happened was this. I will deal with these 3 gliders now. I did see one 2 or 3,000 feet above receiving anti-aircraft fire. That was quite clear. And it came down, we saw it come down, it crashed and burst into flames about 500 yards in that direction. Most of the unfortunate troops inside were killed or very severely wounded, but the officer and 4 or 5 other ranks survived and not too badly damaged. They were able to engage a small part of the enemy, which was making its way in this direction later. That accounts for one of those 3 gliders. Another one, under the second command of the company, Gordon Brown, came down somewhere in the Dee Valley, having not received a signal from here, didn't know what to do, so it landed wide of the mark, fortunately, and that they were unharmed, and the 30 or so troops aboard joined the battalion a day or two later. The 3rd glider had a somewhat more ignominious arrival. It didn't arrive at all here, in point of fact. It came down at RAF Odium in Hampshire, its tow rope having broken. And under its officer, the troops of that particular glider made their way to RAF Brize Norton during the day and hopped to lift with the air landing brigade that night and again subsequently joined the battalion. So there were no gliders. Well, back to the land. At this point, having come through the minefield, I was unfortunately struck in the left leg by a bullet, and my leg folded up, and I went also apex into a bomb crater. I could do nothing for the moment. I can very well remember seeing my batman, who was just alongside or just behind me, looking at me, must say, well, bad luck, mate, and off he went. So my little party had one or two NCOs, there was a sergeant with them, and I think one or two of them probably saw me disappear, which was very odd, and on they went. Fire was increasing, as was also the fire from the guns of Franceville Plage. Eventually, my little party, I followed them up later, they arrived at this casemate and took the surrender of those who were still on their feet. And I might say at this point that most of the enemy were Poles and Russians. They were the garrison of this particular battery, as they were of other batteries and coast defences. They were quite happy, it seemed to me, to put up their hands, lay down their arms, and hope for the best. We had suffered fairly heavy casualties, both on the minefield and, of course, from small arms fire from the battery position. I don't know how long, perhaps 3 or 4 minutes, I was able, having put a tourniquet around my leg of my lanyard, my whistle lanyard, I was able to hobble out of the hole and manage to get here. I came into this entrance below where we are standing and was then faced, of course, with the problem of dealing with the guns, since we had no sappers. Well, now, as I entered, it was still pretty dark, but I could just see in this enormous great casemate a very, very wee little gun. As you have heard, we had expected that the guns would not be less than 150 millimetre, possibly greater, and here was a little thing which I estimated at about 75 millimetre. It was a great disappointment, and it's sort of almost contemptible to come all this way, gone through a certain amount of inconvenience to deal with these guns, and here was this little chap sitting in the middle of this great emplacement, looking rather stupid. However, it was a gun, and obviously it could fire. There were a lot of shells around it, ready to be used, and faced with a problem of doing something to prevent it from firing. Well, I entered this casemate. I was still dragging my left leg behind me somewhat, and I went to the fore end, the front end, and I was just lowering myself onto the sill below the muzzle of the gun when a shell went off outside the aperture. And I felt something hit me in the lower part of my right arm, and a column of blood went up. I said, oh God, I've lost my right hand now. In point of fact, it was nothing more than a nick in my wrist. And sitting there, I thought, well, what are we going to do about this gun? I remembered that we all carried 2 pieces of plastic explosive, detonators and fuse wire and the like. So I said to my gallant sergeant, collect from us all our contributions of PE, somehow make a charge, stuff it in the breech, give me a word, we'll withdraw, light a match, and we'll see what happens. Well, that's exactly what he did. We made a charge, and we, obviously for our own safety, we came outside the casemate, took cover, and there was quite a satisfactory bang, which pleased me immensely. And I went back, and I, with my inexperienced eye, satisfied myself This gun would not fire. That was delightful. Well, now, I was responsible as the OC assault party to the commanding officer, not only for this gun, but for the remaining 3 guns. And I thought, well, I must find out what's going on. In the meantime, my own little party here were clearing up, doing what little they could for the wounded, collecting prisoners and the like. And I started to hobble out to go to this next casemate behind me, number 2, when I met the assistant adjutant. And he told me that time was getting on. I hadn't been considering the time at all, and reminded me that ere long the good ship Arethusa would fire, and that if we remained in the position, it would do us no good. And I said, well, I must go and find out what's happening to these other guns. He said, don't worry, I have been around them all, and as far as I can see, they are satisfactorily damaged. How they were actually dealt with, I don't know in particular, but probably in much the same way as we dealt with this number 1. He told me that the adjutant had been very badly wounded, and I might just digress here for a moment on the subject of the adjutant. He's a very excellent fellow, and this was his first battle experience, and he'd been very seriously wounded in the abdomen, I suspect from shell fire. And we discovered later, this is a story which came out later, but it's quite true, he was so displeased at not being able to engage the enemy that lying on his back somewhere out in the middle here, he took his pistol from its holster, tried to prop himself up a little bit, and thought, well, I'll have one bang at the enemy while I can before I pass out. And he fired his pistol and bored a hole through his left foot. That was his war. He should have died. He was in a terrible state, but I'm glad to say he survived. And I understood from Brigadier Hell the other day that he's now deputy chairman of Lloyd's Underwriters, and he's still got his left foot. Well, now that off that digression, let us go back to our own problem here. It was now daylight, and looking around, it was a grey day, very much like this, a grey morning, very much like this, and a lot of moaning wounded, ally, our own troops and enemy alike, and very few people on their feet as one looked around. The signal officer had inside his battle dress blouse, which he'd bought from England, a clapped out old pigeon. And this was, again, a bit of a gimmick. And the idea was that on success, he would release this wretched pigeon, and it would, you know, do whatever pigeons do and go off, presumably, in a northerly direction. But this particular pigeon was seen flying eastwards towards Berlin. Now, success signals. There have been a variety of success signals detailed in the original plan. And once again, let us revert to this Ford Observer Bombardment Party of naval ratings, which had the right sort of radio to communicate with Arethusa. And the arrangement was that if we had failed to deal with the guns in the battery, that this party would communicate with Arethusa to fire, but not before the agreed hour.